Like announced, I want to introduce Dennis de Vries with us. She's also working and lecturing at the School of Computer Science at Flinders University, has a background as a database, complex database programmer, and is heavily involved in the Play It Again project. And I want to check if Christian is still with us. Christian, hello?
Yep.
Okay. Could you listen to the presentations? Oh.
Yes, I was there. All fine. So, yeah.
There you are. Enjoyed it.
Can you also see us?
I couldn't
applaud. Yes,
all right.
I can.
Then we have almost half an hour left for questions. Please.
Hi. I have a question for Jessica, actually. As a digital archivist as well, and one that is trying to use the techniques in digital forensics in an efficient and effective way. You mentioned taking in materials from Dropbox
mm-hmm.
or email.
Yeah.
And I can also understand not taking disk images of certain media. But I wonder, when you take a material in directly, when it's not on a on a actual hard medium, so to speak, are you concerned about not getting the, for example, last access time or the last time it was modified and those sorts of things? Because I know for myself, I'm concerned about that, but there's often very little I can do without going through extraordinary effort to capture that metadata that's that resides at a file system level. So is there anything, are there any discussions, or is there any techniques that you all are employing to address that?
Like you said, yeah, when stuff comes in like that, and you know, you get the file created date, but that's the date it was sent to you. So no is the sort of the short answer. The longer answer is, you know, we have conversations about that, and the hopes that, you know, well, these files were created recently. Usually when they're being sent in by email or by Dropbox, they're not legacy collections. They're things that people have created quite recently that they want somewhere directly to go into the archives. But yeah, that's definitely the metadata that is attached to those, is basically when it came into the archive. Sorry, I don't have a better answer to that.
I think it's an interesting forensic problem. My limited understanding of the issue is that in order to capture the metadata about the files, you could take a disk image using Unix DD, but if you were to copy the files themselves, there's a risk of changing the last access time.
Yeah, certainly that's what we're running into, because when it's, you know, a Dropbox or an email, we're actually saving a copy. So
yeah.
If I may, you could also try and just have the files that are being transferred to you via Dropbox or via email, these could be zipped, because you could actually store the original file date in the zip. So
mm-hmm.
that would be at least a temporary solution.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
I mean, a lot of files have in their properties all those things anyway.
Yeah, and so we have a metadata extractor that can pull out a lot of that. And I mean, the other thing that we have to take into account is that often our donors don't have the technical wherewithal to, even if you said, can you zip that for me? They'd go, no. they would just, you know, so a lot of it is just being flexible about trying to take what, you know, if we want something, take it in whichever way we can. And then we do a lot with what we call provenance notes that we put into our premise metadata that says if we have to change anything. So we have some sort of coded standardized language that we've come up with. And so we document that, and that goes in with the file, so that we can at least, you know, have that. We've documented what we did.
Yeah, Hi, my name's Ross Spencer from Archives New Zealand, and this is for Joseph. We've got two 8-inch hard disk drives at Archives New Zealand, and they don't work. We use the Cryoflux. I guess there's a whole bunch of questions around that, and just maybe speak to it. How did you source yours? Does it work now? Did you have to fix it? And do you know how to get hold of the skills to fix it?
Yes, it's a problem. For us, we had to find out as many drives as we could. So we have a huge amount of drives in stock. Regarding 3.5-inch drives, you still can find some today in brand new condition. But regarding 5-inch drives, it's more difficult. So we have like 100 units in stock. And if we have a problem with the head or something like that, we switch to a new drive. But of course, as we have nearly 15,000 floppies to preserve, of course we will have at some time to repair, to maintain our stock of drives. I'm sorry, you said a 3-inch drive now?
8-inch.
Oh, 8-inch. 8-inch, we have only 10 drives in stock, but also we are dealing with a very small amount of games released on this format. It's only 100 games released on 8-inch. And strangely, the last drive that were manufactured, sold in Japan is the 8-inch drive, because it's been used by professional servers for quite a long time, and many couldn't migrate in time. So the most recent drives, 8-inch drives, were manufactured like 6 or 7 years ago. So we still can find some in Japan.
Cool. Thank you.
Do you remember that? What we found out not so long ago about the place in America still using 8-inch drives?
Wasn't it?
It was.
Weren't they used in some military context?
Yeah, in the United States, it was just recently in the press about. Yes. Now I would suspect they still had somebody manufacturing 8-inch drives for them. Possibly, but it's worth a try.
Yeah, if I may, just as some kind of feedback, because we've actually seen a lot of these drives. The major issue with all the older 8-inch drives would be that these use mains power, which means they don't operate on 12 volts or 5 volts. They use 110 or 240 volts. And the major issue is that if we'd be providing that service, somebody actually could die in the end when we ship it back. So we've opted not to repair those. But you might actually want to try and go to some local electrician, because usually the issue we found with those drives is, in many cases, is that the brushless motor that's in there, that's working with 240 volts, can be replaced. So that might be an idea. And the other problem you might see with 8-inch drives is only a fraction of them is Shugart compatible. And Shugart compatible is the bus which has been actually became the standard for floppy drives. So anything before that would be proprietary stuff, which could be interfaced to like the Cryoflux or another controller, but you'd actually need to create something in between the drive and the controller itself.
I feel like my question is possibly a little bit out of place because I'm not a technical person at all. But thank you all for your fascinating presentations. My question is for Jessica. I was just trying to get a sense for the extent and the nature of the kinds of collections that you're getting. Mm-hmm. And I was just wondering, you gave some of those fantastic statistics about the number of actual items in the collections, but I was wondering how many sort of individual collections of either wholly or partially digital manuscripts are you taking, like, have you taken in? And also, like, what sorts of collections are there? So, like you said, there was one from an author and one from an arts organisation, but I'd love to know, like, a little bit more about what kinds of collections you're taking in.
Let's see. I don't have the stats on me at the moment, so this is just sort of anecdotal, but those are pretty representative of the, probably of larger collections, but we get a lot of, yeah, sort of organizational records and then personal papers. Personal papers are mostly from writers, politicians, academics, and then different organizations that were active in New Zealand that send us their papers. In terms of the amount, the numbers, I'm not sure about the collections. We're in the process of hopefully getting a new collection management system, so trying to get reports out of our current collection management system is terrible. But I'd say in manuscripts, it's got to be in the hundreds, but I don't know exactly. And like I said, our biggest sort of area is manuscripts, but then we also we have a cartoon archive, so those come in continually to us, and those are sort of like individual cartoons that come in. Pretty big photographic archive, so lots of professional and amateur photographers that send us. And those are pretty large collections usually. And I would say, you know, like I was sort of trying to hint at, is that we see less and less of the physical media, less and less floppies, and more people sending in things on USBs or, you know, they don't want to give us their computers, but we can come and transfer files using external drives.
Hi, I'm Samaya from the National Library of Australia, and we're just all going to pick on you. But this is actually a broader question. I'll come and I'll ask some other questions about cryptographic hashes and keeping that kind of file metadata through processes, because we're running into some problems with files going from one sort of file system to another file system to another file system, so going via
and the encoding and everything gets screwed up.
So mm-hmm. going from MAC formatted NTFS, NFS Plus through to, you know, via whatever various things to NTFS and losing bits and pieces along the way. But I guess my bigger question to all of you is around data security and how you're mitigating the problems around it, how much of it as an NGO, whether data security is important to the government that's supporting and the people that are supporting your organisation, through to government personal papers and archival records, and then I guess the other stuff that's coming through. I don't know, throw the question out there because it's something that's very much on my mind and I suspect a lot of other people's.
Okay, I'll try to answer to start that. I mean, that's one of the things where, you know, I go back and forth like, don't need disk imaging. Well, maybe sometimes it would be really helpful because, you know, I wouldn't run into these stupid encoding problems. But, you know, we haven't really found that we have any changes in files when we're actually at the, you know, when we do the hashes. More of the problems is just the different operating systems not being able to handle file naming conventions. They all have different file naming conventions, and so they fall over on that. But the files themselves, we're not noticing any actual changes and problems.
I find too that you mentioned it about the path names.
Yeah.
So that changes from operating system to operating system, and then you get to, you know, you can't go that deeply down a path, or the path, the actual folder name is too long, and so, you know, how do you deal with that? You know, do you have to modify that, or, well, you have to modify that to be able to do it.
Yeah, I found that when I try and create disk images, that it runs in, it can't handle that either.
Yes, yes.
So it doesn't, you know, that the disk image is not a solution in that case.
Mm.
You know, the solution is sort of just
an issue, which would be an issue of the disk system or of the image file you're talking about, because We actually have that for many legacy systems like the C64, Amiga, Atari, and so on, where we actually have disk images that contain all the original data that have the file structure of the file system. And like we do have actually plugins for like Total Commander, which is a pretty standard file organizer. So you can just look into the disk image and see all the original data as it was, while at the same time you can export all the image, the directory data, like file creation date, file naming, directory structure, and so on. So you can put that in a database and at the same time store the original file. What I'd actually be doing if I would have to do that, I would have both. I would have a copy that's transferred to my local file system where I can immediately access it, and still have the disk image to preserve all, like the hidden bits and stuff, like archival bits or whatever can't be set on the system you're using for your main repository. So.
That makes sense. But the other part about data security. And there are many different definitions of data security. You're talking about who should access it, who should be authorised, all of those different issues. I think we need another conference.
okay, so my question's for Joseph. The other people on the panel, or certainly the person from the library, you're working under copyright law permissions to archive and make copies. Joseph is more similar to our project, because I'm on the Play It Again project, where we're an amateur group of collectors. We don't have any allowances under copyright law to make copies. And I just wondered if you've experienced any problems in that regard in Japan, because I'm not familiar with the law, copyright law in Japan, and you know whether any of the copyright owners have objected to your practices?
Or it's a very difficult question. In Japan, there is no laws about games, so by default it's treated as a book. And we have the right to make a copy, a backup of it, as long as we have the original in our archive. But I won't say that we have permission from the government to do it. But in the end, the idea would be to share our archive with a public archive, such as a library. So today there is no good answer.
It's a
gray zone, but we have to do it anyway before it's too late.
Yes, I agree. It's a very important thing to be done. But I'm just wondering, do you make them available online? Or?
No, absolutely not.
No. So that's the risky area.
Yes. We're talking about preservation techniques. We are sharing our techniques. Mm-hmm. But we are not sharing our archive except for physical materials. So anyone who wants to access our physical archive is welcome to make research. But we cannot share online digital data, unfortunately.
Yes, thanks.
Thank you. My question is for Christian on Skype. I noticed that you've got one of our games preserved there, that's Warlords, so thank you very much for doing that. Two parts to my question. One, can you explain in a little bit more detail that we as developers can understand exactly what you've done to preserve that game? And also, do you want other games of ours, and what would we do if you did, to make them fit in with your preservation process?
Maybe you can introduce briefly yourself to Christian.
Yeah, Gregor Wiley and my colleague Roger Keating from Strategic Studies Group. So we made the wall logo. Oh, and can we get copies of what you've got? Would they be of any use to us?
Okay, I must admit, maybe you're seeing a different game back there. I don't think Wallets is back there, but I'll make sure to check, because I usually should know all about them, but maybe it is there. So talking about that, yes, you can access the data if you are a library, or you can access the data if you are the original developer or creator. And this is actually something, because to also answer the question that was directed at Joseph, yes, usually it's not like people approach us like, how dare you to archive our games? It's usually like, look, we are the original developer, we have lost our files, can we have our files from you? Because you obviously seem to have them in storage. So it's actually the other way around. People aren't upset we are doing this, people are happy we are doing this, and everywhere. Our main developer of the Cryoflux stuff is also working for Sony as a developer, so he's in touch with lots of other developers, and everyone is cheering about that. If people actually want to get something preserved in our archive, they usually send us a physical copy if they have, or we can just ship a Cryoflux dump station. We then do a disk image, we then verify everything is okay, we make sure the data is okay by analyzing the file system, or let's say by analyzing the flux data, which means we can also deal with things that have copy protection applied. We will then store a copy in our archive and of course give it back to the person that actually has been contributing and sending the data into us. But as like Joseph from Japan, we are not putting that data up and online because of the laws that are still in place. I think that actually legislation will have to move on and say something about orphaned works, and Andreas, we are constantly talking about that. This is something that's progressing, where we just need to work with politicians and others to move forward and to get them aware of the problem we are having, at least on the legal side. But yeah, as a developer, you can submit whatever you like to submit, and you can access the data that we might have in storage, and we will give you our preservation containers and everything.
All right, yes, well, we're more than happy for you to do that, just to clarify that point. We're very happy that this stuff is being preserved in some way. We have physical media which may or may not work after all this time, and you know, so it deserves to be looked after properly, so thank you.
Thank you very much.
There is time left for one last question. Okay, if may there I? Isn't any, I... Oh, Christian.
Maybe. Yeah, it's actually for Jessica, because you're actually migrating the data from the disk to your local file system. And I was wondering, what do you do if the disk you're ingesting doesn't have a file system? Because lots of the stuff back from the 80s and 90s might have just a track loader, which means you pop in the disk, the operating system reads the boot track, and from there on it's a program code running, so it doesn't have to use a file system. So I'm wondering, what are you doing in that case?
You know, to be honest, we've never run into that. I think partly it's just the kind of material we're collecting is a lot to do with that, because a lot of what we're collecting is going to be, it's sort of like, you know, what you'd think of as traditional archives, but they're just now born digital. So we're not usually mostly collecting software. That's not, you know, video games is not really something that the library is collecting. The National Film Archive in New Zealand collects video or the games. So usually it's word processing files, spreadsheets, image files. So we haven't actually run into that, I would say.
Okay.
Yeah.
Then one last question from Ian.
Sorry, it's another National Library question. Oh, great. Thank you. another National Library question, sorry. You look for viruses. So I was interested how many viruses you found, and also do you preserve the viruses? Because after all, New Zealand, the stone virus is a Wellington invention and a great example of virus engineering.
As far as I know, we've only ever discovered one virus in the collection. And that was like an older, you know, and there would be viruses in macros and word processing. And when we discovered it, it only worked in like Word 95. So it was almost like, you know, we did isolate it, but and kept it, just isolated it. And the preservation system has a way to do that kind of tracks what you're doing. But it was like our virus checking that we checked when outside of the system before we put it into the system didn't catch it because it was no longer considered a threat because no software would be running something where it would be able to interact with files.
So, but hopefully you haven't deleted it, but because yes. Maybe it's a milestone of software engineering in New Zealand. All right, so if there aren't any questions, I thank you here at the panel. I thank you in the audience, and hopefully we'll meet all together tomorrow again at 9 o'clock in the morning. Have a good night.
Thank you, Andreas.
Thank you.